Hey there, and welcome to Backwoods Belief, episode 5. I'm Jeff Wright here with Ben. Ben, how's life treating you right now, man?
Oh, it's not too bad. Drinking a cup of coffee.
Well, good deal. I not too long ago finished editing episode 4. There'll be a little gap, you know, between when listeners hear this and hopefully when they heard episode 4. But I could use some coffee. That was tougher than I expected.
That's funny. Yeah. So before we get into the topic, there have been some. We haven't really talked about it. I don't think we talked about it at all on episode 4, but just the recent sort of brouhaha that has been happening with the G3 and Christian nationalist guys. Do we want to delve into that for a few minutes here, or just save it for its own episode?
let's dive in, and then we'll come back to it on the episode. I mean, what else sounds do we good. Have to do but kick up dust?
Yeah. It reminds me so much of what we were talking about when we were talking about different episode topics about the frustration of alliances.
Oh gosh.
And how it seems like we're all just kind of stepping on rakes and frustrating our own plans. It's been wild to watch because these are guys who, you know, we consider friends on a bunch of issues and I think are solid brothers, but it just seems like in this particular area, the reasoning has just not been up to par.
Yeah, man, I agree entirely. And I'm not trying to be hyperbolic, but it breaks my heart.
Yeah.
I keep waiting for some group to coalesce, a group of believers that you can kind of link arms with and get to doing some important work. And lo and behold, I'm just constantly disappointed because they turn on each other.
It seems like as soon as that starts to happen, some new thing causes a rift, which is just
and it's nothing not that's pleasant. Important, you know. I mean, I guess I should be careful with that. It is important, but it's not important enough to divide fellowship between brothers who are facing some really enormous challenges in the broader culture.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's a fun thing that's been going on, and we should probably mention too, just because this is sort of our breaking news segment, but the interesting things happening with Davenant right now.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Which I mean, we in the Made to Order Man episode we referenced some of those guys as examples. And it seems to me that they're sort of proving themselves that way with this most recent thing, which apparently there's a book that what's it called? Coronation or something like that Davenant is releasing. And it turns out that the author is not only a universalist, but also supportive of sodomy and just all kinds of
awful things.
I was trying to think of a good word, debauchery, I guess. I mean, that's what the made to order mindset gets you.
The
culture at large is supportive of that. It's not an issue like, you know, race is an issue, and so it's fine to publish someone who believes these things, even though scripture directly contradicts them, not because, you know, scripture has changed, but because the culture tells you now that that actually needs to be celebrated.
Yep. I mean, you said it perfectly there that the listeners probably by the point they hear this will be aware of this controversy, but as we're recording it, you know, it literally broke a couple hours ago. Ben's right. The book is Covenant by John Milbank, and well, you know, Alistair Roberts and his wife helped edit the book. Davenant's all invested and super excited. And about the time they started tweeting, these quotes came up from Milbank where I'm looking at one right now where he says, there is the angelic potential within homosexuality, leading so many gay people to an advanced degree of public dedication and transcendent creativity. I mean, dude, it's awful. And Little John,
I laugh, but it's not funny.
No, it's a catastrophe.
Yeah.
In April, Little John, when people were talking about, hey, Mere Orthodoxy, who you're deeply, you know, involved in and is a sister organization of Davenant, is pushing Tara Isabella Burton.
That's right.
Little John said, hey, if you've got a single example of Davenant publishing or promoting or platforming something soft on homosexuality, I'm all ears. I think our track record on this stuff is unequivocal. Pride goes before a fall, and refusing to hear good faith critics is one of the ways that you engage in a pride that sets you up for a fall.
Yep. Yeah. Once you stiffen your neck to that kind of criticism, you allow the opportunity for Satan to just go crazy because you've hardened yourself to hearing
right.
brothers who have you know even your good in mind, but when you harden yourself against that, it makes it very difficult then to hear.
Absolutely. And again, you know, I probably was never as high on Davenant as some folks, but I remember around, oh, what was the name from the Catholic guy who, he wrote a book playing on the name When Harry Met Sally, but it was about gay marriage.
Oh, I don't know.
Anyway, when that kind of was coming out, this was around Obergefell, Davenant was putting out some good stuff, man. But Alistair Roberts got inner ringed, and Little John's in his inner ring, and so now they've got to be footsie-footsie with homosexuality. And I'm not rooting for Davenant to fall, but again, Levin Levins.
Yeah, and that's another thing that's frustrating about it, too, is these are guys that ought to be on our side. Like, these ought to be friends. But Levin Levins, like you said.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Those are whole other topics. Before we move on, that irony is right. I mean, I'm a Protestant retrievalist. There's a group of people who are kind of Baptist Davenant called the Center for Baptist Renewal. I'm everything that they should, you know, what they say they want. Like, our church is liturgical. We have, a high view of Christ, and we're engaged in, or at least conversant with culture. I mean, like, it's what they're calling for. But they're all sympathetic to the woke and the gay. And because of that, we can't be in fellowship.
Yeah.
Hey, before we, I guess, get back into the Ortland video, I guess the best thing for me to do is to ask our listeners to get with us with some feedback. We're trying something new, incorporating audio. I don't know a lot of podcasts that are doing commentary on other commentary. And so, listener, if you've got thoughts after part one, certainly after part two, we'd love to hear them. Twitter's the best way to do that, right?
Yep.
I did notice, so we've gotten two positive reviews on Apple, but we've also got our first one-star review one-star rating.
Yeah. Oh, it's just a rating. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was hoping we'd have the review, too.
I know. It would have been fun to read, but we didn't get it. We just got the one star, so...
Oh, well.
We'll try harder.
They don't really hate you until they write the review.
Yeah, yeah. And it just seems like a shotgun approach. Like, you said something I don't like, so I'm going to try to lower your online point score. Okay.
The beauty of that is we don't care.
Exactly. It did not actually cost me anything for you to give me a one-star review, but such is the way of 2023.
Yeah.
All right. The first timestamp I've got for this is 20 minutes in, and we were super negative on the previous one, or at least I was. I won't assign that to you. And I do want to say that there is the ancillary stuff that Ortland gets right. And so at 20 minutes, he does a bit of analysis that, he gets the main idea wrong.
In case we have some new listeners, do you want to reintroduce what we're commenting on here?
Yeah, so listeners, if... you want to know what we're doing here in a part two. We're continuing a criticism that I initiated of a guy named Gavin Ortland, who is something of a big name in sort of gospel coalition circles. I'm doing that because, just to be perfectly clear, I have a low view of him. He represents to me the kind of big Eva evangelical who's happy to aspire and try to have that greater prestige by normal church and Christians. And go back to episode 4 of the podcast. It's the part 1 of this little short series. There's a tweet in there that I think is emblematic, and it kind of broke any hope I had for Gavin. He assumes on Twitter that the church-going population of the U.S. is racist. He doesn't demonstrate that. He just assumes it. And then he goes on further to kind of scold in a concerned bros kind of way, that it's controversial for him to say that. Now, he doesn't have evidence that the church is racist, other than people in legacy media who hate the church saying so. He certainly doesn't have, he hasn't established that enough that he can bemoan the fact that it's controversial. I don't know anyone who thinks it's controversial to say Christians shouldn't be racist, but Gavin's wanting cool points in a certain set for that.
Right.
And the irony, since we're talking about C.S. Lewis, if you can just allow me to nerd out just a second, Lewis is famous for sort of inventing a name for a logical fallacy called bulwarism.
Mm-hmm.
And bulwarism assumes the person being criticized is wrong, and then goes on to either delineate or bemoan the fact that they're wrong. So it's a kind of circular argument that has crossed with an ad hominem fallacy, and it's the bulwarism. And again, because he's talking about a Lewis book here, it's just incredibly ironic that a guy who can't understand Lewis's hideous strength but says he loves it is also using the logical fallacy that Lewis mainstreamed or identified in order to score cool points with woke people over and against the local church.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're picking back up with that.
Yeah. So he did a video about how much he loves that hideous strength. And you've probably already heard, we commented on a little bit of it the last time, and we're going to continue doing that. And you said we're going to start at what, the 20 minute mark. Was that right?
Yeah, I think that's where some of the good stuff he has to say begins. And listener, before we hit play on that, I just want to tell you again why we're doing this. It's not because anybody wanted to take Ortland down a peg or, you know, we just felt like picking on that kid and throwing him in a locker. It's that Hideous Strength is such an important book for our cultural moment. And the companion book, The Abolition of Man, which you said you were rereading, Ben?
Yeah, I started rereading it the other day, and man, it holds up so well. I mean, obviously the first essay, Men Without Chests, is a classic on its own, but just the entire book is, I think it's basically like a transcription of three lectures that he gave, but just incredible, incredible foresight into the kind of society we were creating. In the guise of commenting on a grammar book.
Right. So listener, just in case you aren't familiar, one of the central ideas in The Abolition of Man that shows up in that Hideous Strength is that there is a natural law that governs the world. It's an extension and expression of who God is. And to be out of step with it provokes incredible, not just judgment, but just dissonance with the world the way it is. And so the right thing for a creature to do is to align with his creator through the Tao. That's what Lewis calls the natural law.
Yeah.
And that
I've heard more sophisticated people pronounce it Tao, but since this is backwoods belief, we're just going to call it the Tao.
Well, it probably is the Tao, and it's one of those words that I've only ever read. I've never heard pronounced, you know?
Yeah.
So the Tao, like I said. So the Tao, as clearly I knew, Ben.
That was for the listeners.
The embrace of the inner ring, whereby men are induced to do things they would never do if it was given to them as a proposition, but will do in order to have access to a cool kid circle they want to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
That Hideous Strength shows the union of theology to materialist science, which we have seen in recent days with the COVID scolding about loving your neighbors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then how, you know, a theology wedded to materialist science, weaponized by the government, can remake society towards satanic ends, and which we're currently seeing all the time with a regnant regime.
Yeah.
You also got this elevation of an educated elite over the working class that they feel superior to, and you know, this educated elite class feels happy to let the working class work as a kind of disposable putty that they can mold and discard as needed.
Yeah.
And then the last one, and Ben, I know these things are important to you too, so feel free to riff on this, but the thing that the book puts in front of us that I think is so important is that it's unembarrassed to say somebody somewhere is talking to a demon.
Yeah. Once you get to a certain point on the hierarchy, somebody somewhere is speaking to a demon.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
When you look around and say, oh gosh, this looks demonic, guess what, listener? It's because it's demonic.
Yeah, it probably is.
You're not crazy for thinking it's demonic. You're not crazy for noticing it's demonic.
Yeah.
And so when Ortlund, a guy who is kind of the incarnation of what Lewis is trying to criticize in these two books, and he's not the only thing he's trying to criticize, but a significant portion, starts a YouTube video that's getting lauded by people on social media with big followings, talking about that hideous strength. Well, I'm like Michael Jordan. I took offense to that.
Yeah. I took that personally. I think another aspect of it too, and we've talked about this before with other things, is it's like you're the guy who discovered, you know, Led Zeppelin before Led Zeppelin got famous. And then you're, you know, you're real into their music and you know all about it and what it means and what these guys were about. And then suddenly they go mainstream. And now you're like, you know what? I was into it before it was cool. Like, I know what this is about. So there's a small part of me that also has a little bit of that too, where I'm just like, you know what? I mean, obviously I wasn't into C.S. Lewis before he was cool, but I was recognizing how important Abolition of Man is and actually the way that it indicts guys like Gavin Ortlund. So to hear those words coming out of his mouth is, I almost, you know, I took that personally.
This is our hipster moment, man. Yeah. I was totally into Kings of Leon before you were.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, let's actually get into this. Don't you hate podcasts that have like 20 minutes of banter before they get into their topic?
It's a part two. I don't think it's banter. I think it's setup. But yeah, I hate that, and I don't want to do a bunch of that. So 20 minutes in, let's let Ortlund say some good stuff that we can be like, hey, Ortlund says some good stuff.
All right. Here we go. Oh, hold on. Excuse me. Let's try that again.
The realistic and the supernatural, which is a pity because A, it's just the mixture I like, and B, we have to put up with it in real life. He thinks that that's an authentic expression of what life is actually like. That's part of the message of the book. And other reviewers have noticed that. One of the early reviews from August of 1945 said, "It is Mr. Lewis's triumph to have shown with shattering credibility how the pitiful little souls of Jane and Mark Studdock become the apocalyptic battlefield of heaven and hell." Now, there's other strange features of the book, too, but let me dive in and explain the main idea of the book. This will be the second section of the video, and this might start to help us understand why the book is the way it is, and why it's so prophetic, frankly, for our culture today.
Now I'm going to pause here real quick. He says he's going to get into the main idea of the book. Now he does talk about some good, real positive things here, but one of the things you've brought up, I think you brought it up in part one, is that he actually does, in a way, kind of miss the main idea. Would you say that's fair? Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Right. And I think it's because he is the you know, he's the man without chest that Lewis has in mind. But before you hit play, just because I'm straining to say something good, that clip began with Ortlund commenting on George Orwell's critique of that hideous strength. And Orwell criticizes the fact that the supernatural is blended with the mundane. And Ortlund, to his credit, realizes Lewis is intentionally saying the world is a mixture of what we call the supernatural and the mundane. They are not separate, contrary to the materialist's assumptions or, you know, demands. And so, kudos to Ortlund. That's one of the strengths of this book. It reminds you that it is an enchanted world.
Yeah.
But we'll press on.
All right.
Basically a work of social criticism. It's basically a work of critiquing the modern West. And so he, you know, at the very beginning, like a couple sentences into the preface, right out of the gate, he says, "This is a tall story about devilry, though it has behind it a serious point, which I've tried to make in my Abolition of Man." Now, that book was written 2 years earlier. But if you ever have a work of fiction where the author tells you in the first few sentences, "Here's the point of this book," this is, you know, going to be really useful for interpreting the book. And what Lewis is doing in The Abolition of Man is he's defending objective morality, and then he's giving a warning about modernity's desire to have power over nature through technology. And he's basically saying that's like what for pre-modern cultures magic was. And he's saying this is very dangerous. We need to instead accept our limitation and our place within nature rather than try to have power over nature. And basically what he's showing is to have power over nature is ultimately to have nature having power over us.
Can we pause there?
I was literally just about to do that, because I think he is sort of grasping onto sort of with not completely, but he is grasping onto one of the major portions of the theme of the book, which is that, you know, we have limitations and we ought to try to align ourselves with nature. But I think and he may clear this up further on, I can't remember. I think one of the problems, though, is he kind of takes nature to mean like versus technology, which is true. That's not untrue. Mm-hmm. But the way that Lewis is talking about nature really has a lot to do, not just with our external, like how we treat the world around us. It does have to do with that, but it's a lot more about what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman.
Yes, exactly. And again, here in praise of Ortlund, he gets really close, because there is a criticism of technology. But I think Ortlund is importing Tolkien's criticism of technology, because Lewis wants to live. I mean, Ortlund just got done telling us Lewis wants to live in a magical world in this book, because the world we live in is actually magical. He's not. He's not critical of magic. I don't know that he would be critical of technology, unless those things go over and against the Tao, the natural law. And so, like,
right.
Ortlund is right there, but it's just short, because I think he's got his own blinders on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, too, part of the reason that he falls short is because if you actually accept Lewis's premise, or his conclusion even, in Abolition of Man and That Hideous Strength, you have to then reassess a lot of things about the way you do ministry, about the way you present yourself to, you know, the world as, you know, a very, you know, I don't know, would Gavin Ortlund consider himself a complementarian, I guess?
He would, because that's fashionable among his...
Yeah, but, yeah, and what it is you know, it's that, probably that's the soft complementarianism, where God says that men ought to be pastors and men ought to lead their homes, but we can't tell you why.
Right.
One of Lewis's main points in both Abolition of Man and That Hideous Strength, one of the larger points that he gets across, is that actually it's that way because man, as opposed to woman, has been made in a certain way with certain virtues, and woman has been made in a certain way. And when you try to live against that way, the Tao, against natural law, it's actually really disruptive and wicked. It has consequences for your life, and ultimately is demonic. That's the source of it.
Right, because that was you can say this is the temptation in the garden about a lot of different things, right? The temptation of knowledge, to be like God, to transcend mortal restrictions that you have as a creature. So I'm not saying this is exhaustive, but one of the things that the serpent provoked Eve to do was overturn the natural order. And Adam was willing to let it happen, also in his own way, overturning the natural order. And so instead of men judging angels, you've got this angel judging men. Instead of a husband leading his wife, you've got a wife leading her husband in sin and things like that. So you're exactly right. For a guy like Ortlund and the class that he represents, the fact they know they have to give some allegiance to the Bible, but they treat it as if it's arbitrary. Like God could have commanded a world, God could have created a world or demanded in this world that only women be pastors, but he just chose not to, and I guess we got to go along with it. He told us to, rather than understanding it's an expression of who he is, that it is the bedrock, it expresses the bedrock reality that governs and holds together all that is.
Yeah.
That brings me to Jane, Jane Studdick, who's this central character, and that's really the next timestamp I want to get to with Gavin, because this is where he gets some more stuff right. He realizes that even more so, I think, than Mark, Jane is crucial to illustrate the contrast between living against the Tao and living in favor with it. And so I'm not sure what other points you want to look at, but for my part, around 34 minutes, 34:16 is the next thing I want to look at or listen to.
All right. Let me pull that up. 34:16, you said? All right, let's listen.
Wanted above all things not to be interfered with, I had wanted mad wish to call my soul my own. That's the exact position of Jane. And just like Mark and Jane go through this sequential process of their defenses getting broken down in these different ways, so also Lewis talks about his conversion as kind of a slow, piece-by-piece loss of a chess match. Okay, so, you know, I won't go through the full process with Jane. There's several different episodes. The first one is when she meets the director of the manor at St. Anne's. That's Ransom, and she's struck by his kingliness, and Lewis describes she has this experience of hugeness. And then there's several other episodes, which I think I mentioned just a moment ago, but the checkmate for her comes toward the end of the book, when basically she realizes that her view of spiritual reality was egalitarian and democratic. She just basically, you know, thought that ultimately at the top of all things, there must be equality. And she realizes for the first time, there might be differences and contrasts all the way up, richer, sharper, even fiercer at every rung of the ascent. The director is confronting her about her pride and her unwillingness to submit to God. And he says, your trouble has been what the old poets called dangier, or dangier. We call it pride. You are offended by the masculine itself, the loud, eruptive, possessive thing, the gold lion, the bearded bull, the male you could have escaped, for it exists only on the biological level. But the masculine, none of us can escape. What is beyond, above and beyond all things is so masculine that we are all feminine in relation to it. Now, you can see how this will earn Lewis a lot of criticism from egalitarian and feminist scholars, and even his admirers are often embarrassed by these passages. But I think, you know, you have to remember, if Lewis is half as condescending to Jane as he's depicted as, it's curious that he describes his own conversion in the exact same way. I think Lewis is...
Okay.
Yeah.
How good is that reading from Lewis?
I know. it's worth listening to this video just for his reading of Lewis.
Yeah. And... Again, Ortlund is so close because mm-hmm. Jane does mm-hmm. go to a crisis conversion. It yeah. is incredibly important for her that she cast off her egalitarian assumptions. Yes. But this is Ortlund doing what he describes others, like egalitarian and feminist critics. The way he defends Jane's conversion is by saying, oh, it's like C.S. Lewis's. He could not be denigrating her, right?
Yeah. Right.
But in the book... Jane's conversion is built up to through the things he just talked about. Like she starts to see the goodness of a well-ordered society there at St. Anne. She does realize it's in conflict with her egalitarianism. She does come to see, you know, by Ransom's prodding that her pride has prevented her from valuing the masculine. But her conversion is seen when she comes to realize that her degree pursuit should be set aside in favor of having a baby with her husband, because that's the highest expression of who she is as a woman.
Yeah. So what I noticed about that clip is what Gavin does is he takes the talk of masculinity and egalitarianism and immediately spiritualizes it.
Yes.
Which
yes.
is true. Which is true. Like, that's good. But... what Lewis is doing in That Hideous Strength isn't, like, he is avoiding immediately spiritualizing it, which is why the book ends with everybody having sex.
Yes.
His point is, you know, I heard somebody recently use this in talking about some other theological topic, but the phrase was, as above, so below. You know, mm-hmm. just like the things that happen in heaven are sort of played out here on earth as well. And just like there is a masculine and feminine in heaven, there is on earth too. And that's a reality. It's not just that God is the masculine and we're the feminine. You know, we're the bride of Christ. Sure, that's true. That's the spiritual reality. But there's also a reality in nature that reflects that reality. And he kind of jumped over it real quick. He didn't even disagree with it. He just didn't discuss it.
Which is his version of doing what he says the egalitarians and the feminists are doing. He can't yeah. love this thing. He can't come out yeah. with full-throated defense. He has to just immediately run to, Well, he's not a feminist because her conversion is like his.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. It's a very apologetic, very dismissive. You want to get away from that point as quick as possible because you're embarrassed by it.
Exactly. Exactly, Ben. That's it. And listener, here's the thing. We didn't coordinate on this point, but if you're familiar with the book, if you're familiar with Lewis, and if you're listening to Gavin Orland talk about it, I'm assuming some of you are having the same experience. You can hear the embarrassment and the avoidance that is kind of Ortland's version of what Jane is doing. Ortland's embarrassed to say there are ontological realities to which both genders are uniquely and yet distinctly accountable, and they need to pursue them.
Yeah.
But he can't be a winsome witness to the feminists and the egalitarians if he does that.
No.
Hey, before we press play, oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Give me a second. I was going to say, so he has to immediately spiritualize it and, you know, get whatever you do, don't talk about the fact that men and women have a different way, a different law that governs them in this world.
Yes. And, if we let it play, and maybe we should, but
yeah,
Ortland says, hey, submission is not tyrannical because, it gives you a lot of stuff you desire. Again, he's embarrassed of the idea that authority has to be honored. Yeah. And so he has to, kind of grant the term tyranny to the opponents and then say, whoa, yeah, it looks tyrannical to you, but you really get to trade it for what you really want, which is all this human flourishing stuff, right?
Yeah. But
that's the same thing that Creflo Dollar is doing when he tells you, pray to God and honor him so that he'll make you wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bait and switch that turns Christ into a vending machine that gives you what you want. When in reality, Christ's sovereignty is such that even if you get nothing profitable in the immediate sense out of your salvation here on earth, now, of course, there's eternal long-term reward, but in this world, it may cost you everything.
Yeah.
And God is happy to demand it because he is the law to which everything must conform.
Yeah. And in fact, when you order your life according to that law, according to the Tao or, natural law, whatever you want to call it, it actually is good for you because it's what you're made for.
Like, sure.
You don't need to do it so that you can get a blessing. The actual doing of it is the blessing because it's what you were made to do. It's what you're made for. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. So there's this passage I want to read you that if the listener's not convinced about my demand that we see Jane pursuing pregnancy as the way we know she is converted, I just want to read you this section that leapt off the page at me the first time I read it, and I always come back to it as a seminal part. Jane is down on kind of the ground level of the house at St. Anne's. And Merlin and Ransom are up on this balcony kind of looking over where she's at. And Mrs. Dimble is near enough to them to be able to eavesdrop. So the passage begins, Mrs. Dimble heard Merlin saying in what seemed to him a rather strange kind, Mr. Dimble, what seemed to him a rather strange kind of Latin. This is what Merlin says to Ransom. Sir, you have in your house the falsest lady of any at this time alive. And Dimble heard the director say, Sir, you are mistaken. She is doubtless, like all of us, a sinner, but the woman is chaste. They're talking about Jane, who they're literally looking down on at this point. Sir, said Merlin, know well that she has done a thing in Logris, which no less sorrow shall come than came of the stroke of Balinus. For, sir, it was the purpose of God that she and her Lord should between them have begotten a child by whom the enemy should have been put out of Logris for 1,000 years. So Merlin is furious with Jane because in her pursuit of academic success or whatever the modern aspirations she's embraced are, she has neglected her obligation to bear a child with her husband who, Merlin calls her Lord. And it was a cosmic pairing that brought them together. They're, had they reproduced, the child would have protected England, he says, for 1,000 years. And so because he's unwilling to walk in obedience to this calling, he calls her the falsest lady of any at this time alive.
Mm. Yeah. These are the quotes you don't hear Gavin jump to.
Yes. Right. Right. But they're essential to understanding Jane's conversion.
Yeah.
So Ransom responds, because Ransom's not getting it either. She is but lately married, said Ransom. The child may yet be born. Sir, said Merlin, be assured that the child will never be born, for the hour of its begetting is past. Of their own will, they are barren. Can you imagine using that language of voluntary childlessness?
Yeah.
I did not now, this is Merlin again, I did not know till now that the usages of Sulva were so common among you. For 100 generations in 2 lines, the begetting of this child was prepared. And unless God should rip up the work of time, such seed and such an hour in such a land shall never be again. Enough said, answered Ransom. The woman perceives that we're speaking of her. Because Jane's looking up at them.
Yeah.
Merlin finishes this way. It would be great charity, said Merlin, if you gave order that her head should be cut from her shoulders, for it is a weariness to look at her. I mean, the stark contrast between the way Gavin thinks he's defending femininity and natural order and the way Lewis actually does it.
Yeah.
Couldn't be sharper.
Yeah. It would be, well, it would be impossible for someone like Gavin to talk about that kind of thing, because I don't know that he himself has done it, but all of his friends are on a mission to convince you it's okay not to have children. It's mm-hmm. okay not to want to have children. And in fact, it's okay to live your life intentionally single and childless for the glory of God.
Yes, that's been one of their major projects for the last decade, his whole class of evangelicals. And even when he gets a chance on this video, that, I mean, he's the only one talking. He's the one who gets to raise the subject. He gets to just, I mean, he talks about Jane's conversion. He won't go anywhere near it.
Yeah.
While Lewis is having Merlin say, we should probably just execute her for this treason.
Yeah. Now that is a great example of an area where while he wants to defend Lewis, in fact, he can't even discuss the actual content of what Lewis is writing about, because it would be an embarrassment to him and to the ring that he wants to be inside.
Yep.
Like if he talks about these kinds of things, you get the Josh Butler treatment.
Exactly. Yep. You're out of here, man. Because you can affirm, I mean, you can still affirm certain terms, but if you get down to content and specificity, if it's not calibrated correctly to the spirit of the age, hey, pal, you're gone.
Yeah.
And so on, actually, with that, that's perfect setup for, it's like 38 minutes and 45 seconds where kind of the last bit from Ortlund I want to highlight.
Okay. Man, in doing this, I know we're responding to Ortlund's video, but what we really need to do is just go through and just talk about this book ourselves.
Because absolutely.
I keep thinking, like, man, we need to get to, I want to talk about Mark. Like, yeah, there's so much there.
Well, just to jump in there, again, Ortlund, if you listen to the whole thing, friends, and it was in the show notes of the last episode, I'll put it in this one too, go listen to the whole thing. He rightly understands that Mark and Jane's conversion parallel each other.
Yeah.
He sees it. It's just crazy how he analyzes it. He sees a Mark, and I mean, I guess there is some truth to this. His conversion coming by Mark learning that he can't fear being excluded. And again, we've talked about the inner ring. That is part of what's going on with Mark. But and then he talks about Jane coming to learn that she has to stop fearing being included, which, okay, St. Anne's is part of her conversion. But the parallel is that they have both rejected the natural design, the most obvious natural design for a married couple. Jane through academic pursuits and egalitarian commitments, Mark through career advancement and inner ring striving.
Yeah.
But the reason I think exactly Gavin can't say that is because he is a Mark Studdick who is trying to advance himself through inner ring striving.
Yeah. No, I think you're exactly right. You said about 38:15?
38. Let's try 45. I think it's a little past that, but that should put us safely there.
All right. And let's go with that.
And change in life itself. Now, I won't, I'm nearing the time to go home with my daughter, so I won't go into Mark's conversion as much. I've gone into great detail of this in my apologetics book because it's so useful in the context of a moral argument. But let me just say briefly, it's the exact opposite from Jane's. Here's how I put it. I in my article, I say, Jane's deepest fear is being taken in, Mark's is being shut out. She fears intrusion, he fears exclusion. She's always building defensive walls, he is perpetually climbing and then discarding ladders. So Mark is personifies what Lewis calls the inner ring syndrome. He's, you know, at one point you get a glance into his basic psychology when he's trying to justify himself with the thought of partaking in this propaganda. And he says, well, at least nobody will ever have the right to consider me a non-entity. And so he wants to be somebody. He doesn't want to be cast out, you know? And basically, all, by the way, there's some experiences in Lewis's own life, especially at Oxford, that I think play into how he understands this. I go into that in the article. But basically, he has these pre-conversion experiences, and it slowly opens him up. And it's the exact opposite as Jane's, okay? So, you know, whereas she, it's for her, it's joy. For him, it's suffering. For her, it's transcendence. For him, it's morality. And I just talk and I go through the and explain in the article how these are two different. But here's what's so interesting is they, and here's here. Let's finish off, and I'll just dive into the implications of this. So the final section of the video. There's two things about these conversion processes that I think are so helpful as we think about evangelism and commending the gospel today.
All right, can we just pause it there?
It occurs through a complicated sequential process.
All right, so again.
Yeah, we sort of addressed a lot of that already.
Yeah, I didn't realize how much of that was, you know, on my mind as I was thinking about addressing it. But he just did the same, another version of the same thing he did with Jane's conversion. Dealing with Mark, he sort of has this general sketch of what it looks like. And then he goes to like winsome witness in the culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that he can't actually get at Mark's actual conversion is because, again, he is Mark's static. So, Ben, you and I are agreed that Mark's conversion actually happens in the objective room, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You want to sketch really, that out for our listeners if they're not familiar?
Oh, man, it's been so long since I've read the book that I don't know that I can do it justice. But he's like, I can't even remember the context for why he is finally put in the objective room. It's been such a long time since I've read it.
I hate to do this because I've been talking so much, but I'm happy to kind of make a run at it.
No, please do.
So it's kind of the final insistence of the Institute with Mark to go through this objective room. And it's kind of how they know that he's someone who can be relied on in their case to do whatever they tell him. And so they put him in this room that is intentionally designed to disorient because it is a room that appears to violate natural laws. Like, I think there aren't corners.
Yeah, or none of the corners line up quite right.
Right. And so everything is like one of these postmodern, these attempts to build a postmodern building, right? Like stairways into nowhere and things that are designed, if you can imagine, to violate the natural law. And so Mark's in here, he's disoriented, they start strobing lights at him. It's designed to create this sort of hypnotic effect upon him. I mean, it really looks like modern torture techniques. And what it ultimately, the crisis is, he's supposed to stomp on the face of Christ. And when Mark is told to do that, and there are people barking at him doing it, he's in this real environment, the sounds and the lights are overwhelming him. He stops because he can't make himself do that. And it's where he kind of runs up against his red line and says, I can't do that anymore. That's when NICE ejects him. He becomes an enemy of the NICE state. He eventually has to kind of flee and is reunited with Jane. But that is his breaking moment. Mm-hmm. And it's when he found something that he would not trade. I don't think he even anticipated, but he wouldn't trade it for access to the inner ring.
Yeah.
And the reason I don't think that Gavin can talk about that scene when he's talking about Studdick's conversion is that Gavin hasn't yet been in a situation where he has to decide, I value Christ over the allurement of the inner ring. Those things are dovetailed for him.
Yeah. He hasn't quite found that thing yet.
Yeah.
That he's come to a moment of crisis and it is unwilling to trade.
And so we've seen already he's willing to trade the reputation of the Bride of Christ just for some internet points.
Yeah.
The inner ring, because it has been wrapped up in religious terminology, and like his dad pastors a big church. His dad has a big shadow in evangelicalism. I can understand why Gavin would be between the two. But for him, his inner ring is leading him to wicked things too. But he's like, I just thought this was Christianity. And so, I don't think Gavin's in a good place.
No, I think you're right. And it's evident in this video because of the places that he has to rush by or skip over, even in trying to defend Lewis. It's evident that there are the things that he cannot talk about and maybe has reached the point that he cannot even see them because he is so committed to being a part of that evangelical upper class.
Yeah, I legitimately think that's a word. I mean, I'm not his judge. I'm not his Holy Spirit.
Right.
But when I see this stuff from him, I know the circles he moves in. I've seen what's happened to his dad. I just think, like, man, you are studucked. And I don't know, in the Lord's providence, there's no obvious objective room that's going to force this crisis on you.
Yeah.
Well, that's a dark note for me to end my kind of commentary on.
Yeah. No, but it's true. It's true. And I think a lot of the sort of evangelical elite folks who we are talking about, not just in Baptist circles, but in, you know, Presbyterian, Anglican, whatever, you know, denominational world you're living in, there are just things you cannot say, or perhaps cannot even see because you've been so blinded by the desire to be a part of that inner circle. And the rejection of nature has been so normalized, so ingrained in the water that you're drinking, that turn the ship around and now say, actually, we ought to be living according to nature, according to God's law, according to, you know, the way we have been created. There's so much of a current pushing you in the opposite direction that it feels like it would be impossible to turn that around.
I think even if you acknowledge it by, you know, not rushing past some of these graveyards he wants to rush past.
Yeah.
You signal to the group you want to be a part of that you're not exactly the company man.
Yeah, and you sometimes, you'll see this sometimes on social media where you have a guy who has been trying to sort of get into those circles, but he hasn't yet committed all the way. And so he'll agree with something that is like a truly good thing. And immediately the people whose circle he was trying to get into will, and it's not even that he has like turned his back on a particular issue that he was agreeing with before, but he just recognizes, oh, you know, actually Stephen Wolf didn't mean, you know, something bad about other races or other voting blocks. He was just pointing out a particular feature of the white evangelical voting block. So we don't need to make a big deal out of this. Just something as simple as that, just noticing that, hey, actually our, you know, quote unquote enemy did not say the thing that we're saying he said, and he may have a point. That little thing, which is not signing up with the Christian Nationalist Project or something like that, that little thing is enough for those people to then turn on you.
Absolutely.
Josh Butler is another great example of this. We talked about him on an earlier podcast, so I don't want to rehash everything, but you know, you're one of the guys who the Gospel Coalition is platforming. You're publishing a book. You're about to have your debut. What do they call it in those old, like Anna Karenina, like the young kitty is about to have her, like she's about to.
Debutante.
Yeah, yeah, right. You're about to be that guy, but then you say something that's a little bit off, not even maybe off from reality, but just unacceptable. And now you're gone. No one wants to associate with you anymore. And if you're somebody who hungers for that desire to be included, who wants to be a part of the in-group, I can't think of anything more terrifying.
For sure, man. The starling shift. And you didn't know that it was coming. And like the fact that you didn't know the shift was coming indicates you're not in.
Yeah.
it's a bizarre kind of way to have to live. But it happened with Butler. And again, with Butler, it was after all the same people who abandoned him had vetted his book and decided to praise it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just surreal. But that's the kind of thing that makes Ortlund realize, well, I can't talk too much about the specifics of Jane's conversion.
Exactly. Exactly. It's especially, what is it? I've used this quote a number of times. I can't remember if I've used it on this podcast yet, but Upton Sinclair, it's a difficult thing to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it.
Yes, sir.
That quote explains a lot of the behavior you see in these sorts of people.
That is rock solid. Yeah. So I've, you know, and I've been pushing you as well, not just by myself, but so critical about Ortland on this. What are some positive takeaways we could finish with rather than just having to finish on like Ortland's soul may be in danger?
No. I mean, that hideous strength changed my life. Literally. I am not the same person I was before I read that book. And so I totally get his enthusiasm for it. I want for him to see and to talk about all of the things we're saying here that he's missed, because it can only be good for him to get to that point. Like he's noticed some really good and true things about the book. And I just want him to continue noticing the other good and true things, like get to the root of it, because it can only be good for him. So I'm very thankful that he's, you know, out there talking about this book, because it is a fantastic book. Abolition of Man, which is, he rightly suggests, is kind of a related book. It's sort of the nonfiction That Hideous Strength, which, mm-hmm. you know, jokingly, That Hideous Strength already is nonfiction, but it's sort of the philosophical underpinnings of what he's talking about in That Hideous Strength. And so Ortland is correct to point that out. Although I noticed he didn't say anything about Abolition of Man, which, you know, the video's not about that, so he may have just wanted to move on. But I'd love to hear his thoughts about The Abolition of Man, because I think it would be harder for him to talk about that book than it is to talk about That Hideous Strength.
Oh, because the fiction abstracts it enough?
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's interesting. But
so, not to get back into negativity here, the positive things, I'm really thankful that he's you know, enthusiastic about this book, that he wants other people to read it. And, you know, that's great. That's good. I'm also just in, like, positively, That Hideous Strength, and we're going to have to do an episode where we just talk about the book, but it is, like I said, a book that changed my life, because I saw in myself all of those tendencies to be a Mark Studdick. I wanted to be influential. I wanted to be in the inner ring. I wanted the fame and notoriety. I didn't want to be a non-entity.
Mm-hmm.
And reading this book absolutely showed me that. It was like looking into a mirror. And so I, you know, on the positive spin, like the positive note is more about That Hideous Strength than it is about this video. Like this book, if you get the point, it is potent.
Yeah, man. So if I could riff on that, I've in a recent episode, I've commended The Inner Ring as a intentional choice.
Yeah.
So like that, I mean, I think that's a universal experience of feeling pulled by an inner ring. It's why I can still have a degree sympathy for Ortland, even though I've really come to see him as a bad guy.
Yeah.
I know where he's at. The thing is, I hope people will be very careful about which inner rings they give their hearts to. And Lewis, you know, he's famous for being part of the Inklings. But I think it's probably less well known that at one point he and Tolkien self-consciously decided to take over the Oxford English curriculum. And he made a lot of enemies who did that. A lot of people think that's why Lewis was never brought on to full faculty, because, you know, he just stayed a don his whole time at Oxford, had to go to Cambridge to become the chair. His inner ring got up to stuff that they thought was worth making enemies over.
Yeah.
The problem,
there is a righteous kind of inner ring.
Yes, right. And it has to be governed by a righteous principle rather than self-advancement.
Yeah.
Ortland's problem is that his group is like evangelical Paris Hilton's. They're famous for being famous. And they stay that way by self-legitimizing each other. They treat each other as if they matter when there's no real objective reason they do. They just kind of say they do, and they have access to these platforms, and so that makes it so. What I'm hoping our listeners will do is say, you know, what group, what society, and I'm thinking about the church, but there's other ones, what societies are gathered around the kind of principle that would form an inner ring that I could profitably give myself to? And I hope they'll do that with gusto.
Yeah. No, that's a great point.
The last one, nobody listening to this, and you included, would expect me to do this, but I'm going to praise a book, or a point rather, made in a book that Karen Swallow Pryor wrote. Did you see that one coming?
I did not.
So she wrote on reading well.
And yeah.
In the introduction to that, she says that one of the things literature does is it gives us a chance to cultivate virtue without being in a crisis. So by reading the story of these characters, we learn what we should do in those kind of circumstances without it having to actually cost us anything if we're not prepared at that moment to pay it, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I hope everybody will read That Hideous Strength, because considered carefully, it's not a magic book, it's certainly not scripture, but considered carefully, if you read it well, it's going to help you cultivate virtue that may be called upon, because we do live in a world that's enchanted and somebody in power is talking to demons.
Yeah. And that's one of the other positive things I wanted to say, which it may sound like it's not super positive, but I don't think a guy like Gavin Wertland is very, very high up on the hierarchy. You know, I don't think he's the guy talking to demons.
I think he's derivative.
Woefully misguided, like, and is actively in a lot of ways, like self-seeking, trying to rise in the ranks. But I don't think he's the real evil.
Agreed. Maybe the disconnect between the real evil gives you some hope for him.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly my point. I think he, well, I don't want to go that far. He is Mark Studdick at some level, whether he is post-stamping or pre, I don't know. But I'm hopeful that it's pre-objective room.
Yeah. Signal is betraying me over here. I'm sorry for my distraction, but I'm with you. I hope that there is some kind of objective room ahead of him that he can make the turn. I'm not rooting for him to fall. I'd root for him to go the right way.
Exactly.
All right, man. Well, we'll put a bow on it there if you're satisfied.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And there's not really any other clips in that video we want to talk about. So I think that's probably the end of that video for us, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
We don't need a part three. Yeah. All right. Well, again, just as a sign off, I guess, read That Hideous Strength, read Abolition of Man. If you haven't ever read them before, do it. It's worth it.
Absolutely right. Couldn't agree more. And when you do, reach out to us.
Yes. Yeah. So I guess, how can people find you when they're not listening to the podcast, if they just can't get enough Jeff Wright?
Twitter's probably the best. I tweet a lot, too much. I was recently on the Sound of Sanity podcast talking about...
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Talk about that.
Ford versus Ferrari, which is another episode you and I need to do at greater length. But if anybody wants more podcasts, Jeff Wright, Sound of Sanity, Ford versus Ferrari.
Yeah, that's a great movie. You can find me also on Twitter at Bendelwary, and that'll... You know, anything else I'm doing, I do another podcast with a friend of mine about sort of a certain niche of Christian movies that we grew up watching together. So you can find out more about that on there and just see more of my unhinged tweets.
Was it Tribulation Force that y'all did on the last one?
Yeah, we did the second Kirk Cameron Left Behind movie, Left Behind Tribulation Force, which, you know, not to get off on a sidetrack, it wasn't that bad, I'll be honest with you. I didn't hate it. It
was, you're my guy, the first one. You're my guy. I wanted to listen because I'm like, I didn't hate that.
Yeah.
It's good.
I mean, obviously I don't agree with any of the theology of it, but it wasn't a bad movie.
right. All right, well, I've got it downloaded. I hadn't listened yet, but hearing that makes me even more excited to listen. All right, man. Well, I'm ready to wrap it up. Thanks Ben. And
yeah, thank you, listeners. And if you enjoy what we're doing, or if you absolutely hate what we're doing, please leave us a rating and a review. And if you hate us, especially, please leave a review, because we want to know what to keep doing.
Hear, hear. Perfect outro. I got nothing to add. Looking forward to the next episode.